Accession number 27083, reel 44.
So, Henry, you were talking about the raison d'etre behind Dennis Healey's decision to phase out fixed-wing carriers.
Yes, well, he'd taken that decision, and it was all... it was a progression, really, to withdraw from the Far East, to withdraw from the Middle East, to come back, base everything on the UK. The days of empire were over, so why did you need all this stuff further afield, and so on. And the last proper carrier to be, fixed wing carrier to be phased out was the old Ark Royal. And there was a terrific last minute stand. She needed to be refitted and was almost overdue for it. And of course, it turned on the question of money. And I well remember the really astonishing sort of clamour in the, certainly the Navy Department, the untrammeled joy that she was going to be allowed to complete her refit, and hence she would be good for another, whatever, 5 years operational running, and so forth. Precisely what? Precisely how effective operating a single carrier was going to be, I think, escaped attention. And everybody held up their hands and said, oh, whoopee. They went berserk. I'm bound to say I did not. To me, it was anomalous that she should have had that final refit. And of course, the Air Force were fighting tooth and nail to prevent it, because they thought that they might have got the money that otherwise went to the refit of the ship, which they wouldn't have done, but still. It was quite extraordinary, and it was it went from top to bottom, and was emotion gone mad, frankly. But it happened. Now, going back, I'll mention this as, although it's slightly out of sequence, when I first took over, I went along and called on the permanent undersecretary for the Royal Navy. And we then had a permanent secretary of our own, each service did. And ours was a delightful man called Peter Carey. And I went along to call on him one evening at about, I don't know what it was, 5:30, 6 o'clock. And he was a most charming person and a very effective permanent undersecretary. In his spare time, if he ever had any, he used to actually make violins exquisitely. Very talented person. And sadly, he died young. And he received me with great courtesy, and immediately started to apologize and say, I'm frightfully sorry. Normally your call would have been a full 30 minutes, but I have to go along to see the First Sea Lord over the much vexed question of rum and the possible abolition of the tot. This came as a bit of a surprise to me that there should be any further discussion about it. And we talked of this and that and so forth. And he came back to it right at the end and said, well, looking at his watch, I'm frightfully sorry, I must go now because it's quite important. After all, no First Sea Lord would like to go down in history as being the one who was responsible for the abolition of the tot. Oh, I said, sir, why not? And he stopped in his tracks and he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, this issue has been ducked for years, for decades. It's grossly outdated. And any first-degree lord who did abolish the tot ought to be very proud that he was the first to have the guts to do so. Oh, he said, well, that's a novel approach to me. You better walk down the corridor with me and come along. Why do you say that? And I said, well, it's grossly outdated. It's long since served its purpose. It is responsible for, I wouldn't care to put a figure on it, but at least a third, if not a half, of the acts of indiscipline that occur in ships and the fleet, with people having had a birthday party and borrowed somebody else's tot and that sort of thing, and had one too many, and so forth. I said it's a constant menace to ships on operational duties in time of war, e.g. the Korean War, where the carriers found, and you will recall that the normal time for the daily issue of the rum ration was noon, and because it meant that anybody who was dealing with flying operations in the course of the afternoon was that much more stupid as a result of their tot, the carriers used to work a routine whereby the afternoon watchmen drew their tot when they came off watch in the evening, and that was why. And I said, it's absolutely absurd. You draw your tot at midday. You grab a bit of food. Shortly before 12:30, you close up in a darkened ops room, and you bury your head into a radar scan that's going wang, 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 and you pretend that you're efficient. And it's pie in the sky. You're not efficient. And it's the tot that has made it so. Oh, he said, well, I said, you know, it's absolutely absurd. It's really, it's long, long overdue, and any first sea lord should be proud of it. That was the end of that conversation. I'll return to that subject later, when I'm again at sea and commanding a ship which had to do the sort of publicity side of the abolition of the tot. But that was quite an interesting thing, and what he said to the First Sea Lord, I don't know, but it didn't happen then.
Just tell me how much the tot was. I thought it was a conventional measure. Obviously not.
Oh, it was, yes.
It was a conventional measure.
It was about a third of a tumblerful of neat rum, but the other two-thirds were water, and it was watered down for junior rates, leading hands and below. If you were a petty officer or above, then you drew your tot neat. And you could keep your tot, you could bottle it up neat, and it would keep. But once it had been had water added and then became it became grog then, and it wouldn't keep. It would go flat, and it was rather unpleasant. And it was a well-known thing. You drew it at the age, I think I got this right from memory, you drew it at the age of 18. Quite a number of youngsters who were under 18. Now, quite a lot of those hitting the age of 18 didn't particularly want to draw their tot. And if they didn't, and they were known as TT, they got threepence a day in lieu. But, of course, all the old sweats, the three badgemen, would lean on the youngsters and say, come on, lad, you know, you draw your tot and I'll make it all right with you. And that sort of thing. And there was a calculated antipathy towards those who didn't draw their tot. And they were regarded, on the whole, they tended to be regarded as wimps. They weren't manly enough. They weren't up to it. It was pretty sloppy stuff, which was a form of mental harassment amounting almost to bullying. And there it was. And of course, somebody had a birthday, particularly if you were a senior age. And there were ways round it. You could still bottle your tot. It was a discipline offence if you were discovered. But it went on, and there was a locker in which you could hide it and so forth. And there was case after case of some bit of indiscipline because someone had refused an order or had been bolshy and that sort of thing, having drink taken, too much drink taken. Well, I'll deal with what happened in substitution of it later on when it actually occurred. But it wasn't then. It wasn't in my time during Directorate of Plans. I've covered the Ark Royal's final refit, and I remember a lot of work was done over the question of providing cover for the Far East Fleet withdrawal, because we were going to pull out of the Far East. And to this day, I find it grossly illogical that so much naval talent was in terms of ships and so forth, was concentrated, so-called, to cover the Far East fleet, or to cover the Far East withdrawal. And what was it required to cover against? What was the threat? And frankly, there wasn't one. And the poor old Malays, they weren't going to rough it up. They were only too glad to see us off so that they could take over and so on. And there was no threat. But it was a very poorly argued and very illogical, I think, device to justify the numbers that we had at sea in the Far East. And hence, to that extent, you could argue the size of the Navy as a whole. And the time came for me to call on the new Undersecretary of State for the Royal Navy. I can't remember who it had been before, but the incomer was David Owen of Lib Dem fame later, or infame. Actually, I have a very high respect for him, and he today, I reckon he's one of the few statesmen we still possess, and I'll get that out of my system right away. He's a very good man, I think. I have to add that he wasn't all that good then. He was young and he was keen and so forth, and somewhat difficult to work with and for. And when he later went on to become Foreign Secretary, he forgot his old friends in the Navy Department of the MOD and didn't behave terribly well. But all that's changed, and he's a great man now. So I went and called on him, and he couldn't have been more charming, and he we chatted about anything under the sun for 10 minutes or so, and then he said, well, now we must get down to business. I have some questions I want to put to you. And I had checked out with my vice chief, with Peter Hill Norton, that it was okay for me to go and see him, and I had been sent for. And he said, yes, be careful you adhere to current policy. And that's it. And of course, he had he'd had discussions with every board member and the vice chief separately and so on. And now he was picking up the bits a bit lower down. And I think that it had been his intention, and I don't mean this nastily, that by dipping a bit further down, he might get closer to reality and the truth as opposed to rigid adherence to some policy which ran departmental-wide. And so indeed it turned out. And he kicked off and he said, Now, why do we need all these ships to cover the Far East with gold? Roughly as I've just said to you, who are they covering against? Why is it necessary? And I couldn't have agreed more with him, but I was under remit, of course, to toe the party line. So, wrapping it up as best I could, I towed the party line, and I could see, almost physically, a shutter come down, and he thought that he was going to get the truth out of Leach, and he wasn't. He was getting the party line. And I suppose the interview then ground to a halt after 40 minutes or so. We had a number of other things discussed, but of no great consequence. And the time came for me to go. And as I got up to leave, I said, I'm sorry to have disappointed you in some of my answers, but if you think about it, you will realize that I was really, I had no option but to tell you the departmental policy. However, would you care to walk round my my division, my directorate, in due course when you've had time to settle in? You'll be very welcome. And you can have a cup of tea in the end room where we all gather and that sort of thing. And in due course, a month or so later, this was arranged. And when I went up to collect him, clear in my mind was this rather unsatisfactory interview I'd personally had with him. And I went up and said, "Now, sir, I have I've briefed my people that they can say anything they like to you. So any question you put to them, and they will tell you precisely what they think. And the only reservation I put on them is that they must make it quite clear to you whether they are expressing their personal thoughts or whether they are expressing what they understand to be policy. And that's all. But they will answer anything. So if you want to say, why the hell do we need a navy at all, you'll get some answers." And round he came.
And did you clear this approach with Peter Hill Norton?
No.
Right.
Because I was playing it straight, and that was fun. But I had briefed him very carefully. I said, "You can say anything you like. You can say the most outrageous things, but you've got to make it quite clear in advance of your statement whether your statement is policy or personal." And he came round, and he was pathetic. And he said, "How long have you been in the job? And are you enjoying it? And do you ever see your wife?" And that sort of thing. And it was a complete passive flash. It was a marvellous opportunity for the boys to let fly. Mm. But they didn't. Because they weren't asked. Then, I'm picking things slightly at random. And really so much happened in the 2.5 years I was in the job. That the rather mediocre amount of detail I've passed on to looks as if it wasn't much of a job, and actually it was very busy the whole time. We managed to find a flat down in Old Chelsea, and that was all right, but it was just too far to walk from the flat to the MOD. Particularly if one was coming in a bit earlier, as not infrequently was the case. And I would get up and catch a number 11 bus about 6:30 in the morning with all the chars going to work. And they were a super lot. And it was only a dog's hop away from my funny little flat. And if I cut it a bit fine, and the bus was not going to wait for me, and it was beginning to move off. So I had to pick up and run for it. And I just made it. And they'd all drop their papers or their knitting or whatever and give me a chair. Nobody else did at the other end. So that was quite entertaining. And then one Friday evening, I was in my room working a bit later than most, because people tried to get away on a Friday evening for the weekends, and so did I. But I was working a bit later this time. And there was a thing called war indicators. And this, for example, was a situation where suddenly and over a protracted period there would be intense communications intercepted, and this is Russia, of course, or you would become aware, one means or another, that all the Soviet Air Force had been grounded, not just a type, but all. I won't go on. But these were classed as war indicators, because for obvious reasons, activity was hotted up in terms of communications, or they were preserving their talent if they grounded aircraft, etc., etc. And I can't remember which one it was, but one of these indicators featured. And it was 5 o'clock on a Friday evening. And it was almost out of the book. It was almost verbatim from that line of the list of indicators. And the vice chief had gone home. And so I went up to Ian Easton, the assistant chief policy, who was actually my immediate boss, and put this to him. And he was itching to get home too, and a bit upset. So was I, frankly. But I didn't think one could responsibly just go without something having been done about this situation. So I put it to him. And he checked out, and he said, well, leave it with me. I'll have a word with the center and all that sort of thing. And he got hold of me about an hour or so later and said he discussed it with various people. And the thing had eased down somewhat. And he got another slant on it, and the intelligence lot were... had been brought in, and what did they think, and what did they know, if anything about it. But it went on, rather draying on, until about 8 o'clock that night, and then it was judged to be a false alarm. And I left and went home, hoping we'd got it right, because if we hadn't, it could matter quite a bit. And I mention that because, although we had all these fine things, it would have taken quite something to have rocked the boat to the extent of stopping people going home on their weekends leave. We were in deep peace, whatever we might publicly have said about it.
Well, this was the point I was going to ask, because surely these indicators would have been accompanied by... or you would have analysed them in the light of the current prevailing political international situation. And if there was a relative degree of calm between East and West, would you not have regarded these indicators as being not reflecting the true position?
Indeed, and I think that's why we eventually concluded that it was a false alarm. But nevertheless, it was almost a copybook of this particular, and I can't remember what it was, this particular indicator. I think it was to do with grounding aircraft. So that was that one. Interesting. Well, then we had a period of all change. And Peter Hall Norton was relieved by Edward Ashmore. And Varel Begg was relieved by Michael Lefanu. And each was radically different to his predecessor. And it was quite interesting for someone like the Director of Naval Plans. Peter Ashmore firmly believed that the most important NATO front was the Northern Front. Peter Norton had believed that the most important NATO front was the southern region, the Mediterranean. Verrill Begg, the previous First Sea Lord, had gone in for really very detailed and intense briefing meetings before a Chiefs of Staff meeting. And it had become the fashion, in my opinion, a very good one, that not only did the top men and at director's level attend the briefings, but even the desk officer responsible for a particular paper that had gone up through the system for use by the First Sea Lord at the Chiefs of Staff meeting. And Michael Leffenhoe didn't like it that way. He was a great one for playing it off the cuff. He was a totally different personality. He was very unorthodox. He was very untypical. He was very clever. He reckoned he could get by in any circumstances pretty well without any briefing. Rather took the line, what are all these people here for? Didn't like it much, and so forth. It was a radical change, and it was quite difficult to retune oneself to match the new hierarchy. And then the day came when there was a visiting Swedish squadron, and it moored off Greenwich. And they threw a lunch party, and they asked the new First Sea Lord to go down to lunch. And I, as a senior captain, was asked along, I think I'd probably picked by Michael Leffenhoe, as just make up fee to make another one at a different level, and so on. And we had quite a good lunch party. And in the middle of lunch, I remember one of the, I think it was the Swedish admiral, to whom Leffenhoe was talking at the time, and he'd been explaining to his Swedish host what the various other supporting cast, the posts they held in the Minister of Defence and so forth. And there was the Director of Naval Operations and Trade, one Terence Martin, very nice chap, great friend, etc., etc. And it was at the stage when I was pretty well at the end of my time as Director of Plans, and I would then go to sea. And there was a bit of a sort of sweepstake going round as to where I'd be going. And the name Ark Royal featured quite prominently on some lips.
The newly refitted Ark Royal?
Yes. And other lips said, no, that must go to an aviator and that sort of thing. There was no must about it at all. Anyway, in the course of this curious conversation between Leffenhoe and the Swedish admiral, they got on to the subject of Leach and where was he? What did Leach do? He was told that I was director of plans. And the Swedish admiral said something about, how long does he do that for? Oh, said Leffenhoe, and you know, I'd heard this going on when an air cocked. Oh, said Leffenhoe, he's got to go to sea again. He's going to drive the carrier Albion. And that was the first time I heard that I was going to be appointed to the Albion. And that was that. But a very odd way of doing business. And, you know, it was sent for me and said, I want you to go and drive the Albion. But he didn't play it that way.
Yes.
At all. So, very odd. So, there it was. In 1970.
So in 1970, you leave your post as director of Naval Plans and join Albin.
That's right. And I joined her in Portsmouth in March 1970.